Welcome to the Deadcast.
I'm going to the suburbs of Portland, Oregon, a community understandably racked with fear after two young girls believed to have been abducted disappear in a space of 2 months. Now, the first to vanish was 12-year-old Ashley Pond, last seen January 9th, walking to a school bus stop. Ashley might have been written off as a runaway, but on March 18th, Miranda Gaddis, Ashley's good friend, also disappeared on her way to school without a trace.
By sheer chance, I had spoken with Miranda about her missing friend.
It's really hard to believe that having one of your friends or something, it's just really different and really sad.
That exchange took place at the school bus stop. Ashley and Miranda never made it to the mornings they vanished. Up the hill from the apartment complex where they lived and right outside the home of Ward Weaver. The girls were both friends with Weaver's daughter. They were on the dance team at school with her, and both had spent nights at his home. Sleepovers he seemed excited describing when we first talked to him in July.
You could not walk anywhere in my front room without stepping on a body.
See, we were on to Ward Weaver based on a tip we received about the bushy-haired neighbor at the top of the hill. And it wouldn't take long in the course of this conversation to learn why.
They are hassling my family, my friends. They are saying that I am the number one suspect.
He told me he flunked two polygraph tests, but also walked me through his home to show he had nothing to hide. A month later, I learned the truth. He was taunting me here. He'd already buried Ashley under this concrete slab, and he'd used this freezer to store Miranda's body. Realities that became evident by the end of the summer, bringing out the vulnerabilities in all of us.
At about 4:15 this afternoon, the Oregon State Medical Examiner has positively identified the remains discovered yesterday as the body of Miranda Gaddis.
Hello again and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you as you join me today while we look at the disappearance and murder of Ashley Marie Pond
and her friend Miranda Gaddis in 2002.
Before we dive in this week, as always, I'd like to remind you that you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Author Totten. That's AUTHORTOTTEN. You can find me on Facebook at Ian Totten, author. There's a tab on that page that'll take you right to the Deathcast group where we discuss the cases covered on the show as well as all aspects of true crime. If you'd like to help support the show, I am on Patreon at Ian Totten, author, or if you want to make a one-time donation, PayPal at Ian Totten. Now that the plugs are out of the way, grab yourself something to drink. I have my coffee and my cigarettes. Sit back, relax, and let's go into the crypt. Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis were two 12-year-old girls who lived in the New Elk Creek Village Apartments in Oregon City, Oregon. Ashley was described as a popular student who was on the swim team and along with her friend Miranda was on the school's dance team. We're going to be looking at Ashley first as she was reported missing first.
She was born March 1st, 1989 to a woman named Lori.
Ashley's birth father was a man by the name of Wesley Roetger,
although Ashley was unaware of this until she was 9 years old.
At the time of her birth, Ashley's mother was going out with a man by the name of David Pond, and the two eventually married, with David treating Ashley as his own daughter. Ashley has been described as a quiet, well-behaved child
who could entertain herself for hours and enjoyed being hugged.
Ashley had a fairly regular upbringing until the time she was about 9 years old when David and Lori divorced. The divorce had a devastating effect on the young girl who was caught in the crosshairs, as Lori wanted child support payments, which David refused to pay.
A paternity test was ordered, at which time it was discovered that Wesley was Ashley's real father.
She began spending time on the weekends with Roetger, and family and friends all noted an instant change in her attitude as she became sullen and withdrawn, later turning to confrontational. It got to the point that Ashley would resist going with her father, and eventually Lori pressed her on the issue, only to discover that Wesley had been sexually abusing the young girl. In January of 2001, Wesley Roediger was indicted on 40 counts of raping and sexually abusing his daughter, but 8 months later, most counts were dropped, and he eventually pleaded no contest to one count and was released on probation. This is the kind of thing that absolutely sickens me, to see someone do that to a child, and I really believe that in this day and age, Wesley would be receiving a serious prison term, although I think for pedophiles, that sentence is far too light, but that's a story for another time. Over the ensuing months, police were called to the Pond residence numerous times, including one incident where Lori was found to be drunk and neglecting her children. It was because of all this turmoil that Ashley began spending a lot of time with the Weaver family, whose young daughter was in Ashley's grade and who she was friends with. Now, if you see pictures of Ashley, she's seems to be a happy, bubbly child, but that couldn't have been further from the truth, because the abuse that had begun at the hands of her father was to continue, and it's been reported that at least one teacher attempted to make the school and through them the police aware of this, as this teacher, Ashley's reading teacher, stated that she witnessed the patriarch of the Weaver family, a man by the name of Ward, kissing Ashley on the lips, although at the time nothing was done about it. Ashley spent most of the first half 2001 with the Weaver family, including accompanying them on a 2-week vacation to California, while the situation at Ashley's home continued to deteriorate with the police being called out multiple times, usually in regard to her mother neglecting the children and drinking. And knowing what we know now, I have to wonder if the police had taken a closer look at Ashley's life, they may have discovered the abuse she was suffering and therefore might have survived. In early August of 2001, Ashley confided to a reading teacher that Ward Weaver was molesting her and that he had threatened to testify against her in her father's rape trial
if she dared to tell anybody about the abuse.
I have read some accounts that she had also accused two other men of molesting her, but she later recanted this, although I have found no real corroborating any evidence. In any event, after she had made the accusations against Weaver, Ashley stopped going over to their home and began to feel ostracized from the family.
And it's really sad to look at this case, because if this were to happen now in 2020 in our hypersensitive society, the police would be all over Ward Weaver, investigating his background to try and find the validity of the accusations. And as it was 2001, they did what they did back then, which is drag their feet on the case. On January 9th, 2002, Ashley called out goodbye to her mother around 8:15 and headed out to the bus stop. She was never seen again. That afternoon, when she did not return home, her mother, Lori, began asking around the neighborhood and quickly ascertained that Ashley had not even gotten onto the bus. She called the police and informed them that her daughter was missing, insisting that the young girl had not run away. A fairly large search party was organized with Ashley's mother, as well as Miranda Geddes, getting involved in it. They canvassed the entire neighborhood. There were even a number of news pieces about the disappearance. This was a fairly big story in Oregon City. The dance troupe that she was a part of even organized a benefit for her, scheduled to take place on March 23rd of that year, which is where the
clip at the beginning of today's episode of Miranda Geddes leading with her friend to return home comes from. Unfortunately, Miranda would not get to participate in the dance fundraiser as she disappeared not long after on March 8th, 2002. Who was Miranda Geddes? Miranda was born on November 18th, 1988 to Michelle and Jason Geddes. Miranda has been described as a girly girl who enjoyed dancing and wearing glitter. And she, like her friend Ashley, came from a troubled, broken home. In fact, when Miranda was 6 years old in 1995, her father was arrested for sexually assaulting two minors, one of whom was his own daughter, Miranda. When the police came to the house, Jason grabbed his young daughter and held her against him, demanding that the police leave before he release her. Instead, he was tackled from behind by police officers and taken into custody. Jason ended up getting 6 months in prison and 54 years of post-release supervision for his crimes. And at some point during this, naturally, Miranda's mother, Michelle, divorced her father and got into a relationship with a man by the name of Brett Edward McEaney. Brett, much like Jason, had a taste for young girls, and he began to sexually molest Miranda and two other young girls before eventually being convicted of his crimes. Following all of this, Miranda and her two siblings were removed from her mother's home and placed in a foster care for 18 months, with Miranda going on to receive counseling to help her deal with the abuse that she had suffered. During this counseling, Miranda wrote an essay on child abuse that was said to be so powerful that a nonprofit ended up using it in their training manuals. One line from the essay has been seen as somewhat prophetic, as Miranda wrote that people getting physically and sexually abused is a huge problem in the world. It can kill people. March 8th, 2002, Miranda was last seen in her kitchen preparing her lunch. Her mother, Michelle, said goodbye to her and headed out the door, believing that Miranda would do what she always did, get herself ready for school. At roughly 1:30 that afternoon, she received a phone call from her oldest daughter informing her that Miranda was not at school. Upon contacting the school to learn what was going on, Michelle learned that Miranda had missed every class that day. Knowing that something was wrong, what with Ashley Pond having gone missing not 2 months beforehand, Michelle contacted local law enforcement, and in no time, both state and federal law enforcement were involved in locating Miranda. It wasn't long before both Ashley and Miranda's disappearances were being broadcast nationwide, including being shown on the television show Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack. Unfortunately, however, the police really had no leads, with the FBI stating there is a growing belief the cases are related, and while there's a slight hope that they have run away, there is a growing belief that there was some kind of criminal activity involved. And it's really surprising to me that the police and the FBI didn't take a closer look at the individuals who lived in the apartment complex where both Ashley and Miranda lived, because I really think that had they done so, they might have come upon their suspect sooner, instead of waiting for that suspect to begin making waves of his own and point the spotlight on himself. At some point during the ensuing months,
Ward Francis Weaver III, born April 6, 1963, contacted one of the local television stations and informed them that he was a suspect in the case and he wanted to clear the air on his side of the story. You can find it if you really look hard, but there is an interview with Ward Weaver out there where he's boasting about how much he enjoyed having the girls over at the house and how they always were having sleepovers, and of him showing off his house and explaining that he is the number one suspect, but that it's really bothering him because they are harassing him and his family. At one point, Weaver is standing on top of a newly poured slab of concrete in the backyard, where he exclaimed, "I have no problem with them looking at me as a suspect. The problems are coming with what they're doing as far as questions that are being asked of my family. They're telling parents of my daughter's friends not to let their daughter spend the night because I'm a prime suspect and their daughter might be next." If Ward Weaver wasn't being looked at as a suspect prior to this, he most certainly was now. But who exactly is Ward Weaver? As I said, Ward Weaver III was born April 6, 1963 in Humboldt County, California, to Trish and Ward Weaver Jr. In 1967, Weaver's father abandoned the family. A few years after that, his mother married a man by the name of Bob Budrow, who was an abusive alcoholic, and the family relocated to Portland, Oregon. Weaver has been said to have displayed antisocial personality traits from an early age, and his sister Tammy has claimed that Weaver physically and sexually abused at least one family member by the time he was 12 years old, while his half-brother Robert has stated that Weaver frequently beat them during their childhood. In 1981, a relative of Weaver reported that he had beaten and raped her, and the police investigated, only for the police to decide not to pursue things further when they learned that Weaver would be leaving Portland after graduation and joining the military. At some point during the year of 1981, Ward's father, Ward Weaver Jr., murdered an 18-year-old Air Force recruit by the name of Robert Radford and his 23-year-old girlfriend, Barbara Lavoie. Weaver apparently beat the man with a piece of pipe before raping and strangling Lavoie. Afterwards, he cut the woman's body into three pieces and buried it in his backyard before sealing her grave with a concrete slab and building a deck on top of it. Just an eerie bit of trivia, as you'll find out in the not-too-distant future. Our Weaver, Ward Weaver III, ended up stationed on the USS Coral Sea, which was an aircraft carrier, in the Philippines. Although he would not be in the Navy very long, he was discharged in 1982 for missing work and because of his drinking. And upon returning to Portland to live with his mother, he brought a Filipino woman by the name of Maria Stout. She would eventually become Weaver's first wife, and it didn't take very long for her to end up pregnant. 5 months into the pregnancy, she ended up at the hospital claiming that Weaver had beaten her, saying that he had slapped her, pulled her hair, and banged her head against the bed. Weaver was arrested for this, although Maria refused to press charges and Weaver was let go. In December of 1982, their first child, Francis Paul Weaver, was born.
and Maria were married in 1984, at which point they relocated to Bakersfield, California. Some point around this time, the Weavers' children were taken into the foster care system for unspecified reasons, although I have a feeling it is related to Weaver's alcohol and drug abuse as well as his violent acts. In 1986, the Weavers were living in Fairfield, California with the Ordonia family and their two children. On Father's Day of that year, he went out drinking at a local bowling alley. Around midnight, 16-year-old Jennifer Ordonia and her younger sister Jocelyn picked Weaver up at the bowling alley to bring him home. Not long after, they pulled onto a side road so that Weaver could relieve himself, at which point he attacked Jennifer, opening the passenger side door and hitting her in the head with a chunk of concrete before grabbing her into a headlock. Jennifer was able to escape Weaver's clutches, later telling a reporter that Weaver had a blank, expressionless face, almost as though he were sleepwalking. Weaver was released from prison in January of 1988, at which point he collected his wife and family, and they moved to Canby, Oregon, where they briefly ran a gift shop. Somewhere around this time, the Weavers welcomed their fourth child into the world, and Ward began selling cocaine and methamphetamine. This would eventually lead to his divorce in 1993 when Maria filed a restraining order against him, citing his years of chronic abuse, although it wouldn't be long before Ward Weaver was in another relationship.
First, this message. Authors and small business owners, are you looking for an inexpensive, effective way to promote your business and get new customers? Promoting on a podcast such as this one will introduce your product to hundreds of new potential customers on a daily basis. I can tell you from my own experience having done it that promoting through a podcast is the best investment I ever made. My last two books, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia and The House of Silver Doors, were both promoted on the Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry podcast, and I saw immediate results, with sales nearly doubling overnight. Now, I know what you're thinking, promoting on a podcast has to be expensive. Well, that's not true. If you contact me at authoriantotten@gmail.com, that's AUTHORIANTOTTEN@gmail.com, I promise you I will give you the best deal on podcast advertising going today. I can tell you from trying to run ads on other shows, you can end up spending it from $5 to over $1,000 a placement. But if you contact me today at authoriantotten@gmail.com, I'm going to give you 2 weeks for the price of one, and it's not even going to cost you a fraction of that. Now, the best part about placing an ad on a podcast is there's no shelf life to that ad, unlike a place like Facebook where you have to put an end to your ad campaign. I'm not going to go back through and re-edit the podcast to remove your ad, so it's going to be there permanently. So contact me at authoriantotten@gmail.com and expand your business today.
1994 found Weaver in a relationship with 18-year-old Christy Sloan, whom he beat in the head with a cast iron skillet in their Portland apartment. Sloan eventually dropped the charges against Weaver, who was sitting in a jail cell, as she told the prosecutor she was too scared of Weaver to testify against him. Despite this, the couple eventually married and stayed married for the next 4 years before getting a divorce. Again, Weaver's violent, abusive nature was cited as the main reason for the dissolution of their marriage, along with the fact that Weaver was two-timing her. In fact, he had begun an affair with a woman he met at work,
And after the divorce was finalized, the two of them moved into a rented house on South Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City. This is the same house that they would live at when Miranda Geddes and Ashley Bond disappeared. So at this point, we have the two disappearances, as well as one neighbor who has been accused by Ashley Bond of sexually abusing her. And he's acting oddly, but his actions were odd well before he contacted the local media. In fact, on the day Miranda Geddes went missing, March 8th, Ward Weaver had his son Francis help him dig a large hole in their backyard for what he claimed was a concrete pad where he was going to place a hot tub. It was this same pad that he stood on during his television interview where he talked about being the prime suspect for both the local police and the FBI. Things came to a head on April 13th of 2002 when Weaver's son Francis called the police and claimed that he had attempted to rape his 19-year-old girlfriend. The police were already aware of this crime, however, as a 19-year-old woman who was wearing nothing but a blue tarp waved down motorists near South Beaver Creek Road and got a ride to a local shoe store, at which time she contacted police and told them that Ward Weaver had raped her before attempting to kill her. Now, when Francis spoke to the police, he informed them that he believed his father should be a suspect in the disappearance of Ashley Bond and Miranda Geddes. Weaver was arrested for the sexual assault and attempted murder, and law enforcement began going over his property with a fine-tooth comb. At the same time, Ashley Pond's stepmother, who had suspected Weaver in both disappearances, erected a sign next to the concrete slab on his property, which read, "Dig me up." On August 24th of 2002, the FBI found the body of Miranda Geddes inside an empty microwave box in a storage shed at the back of Weaver's property, and it would later come to light that he had stored her inside a refrigerator on his property, and that her body had been inside this refrigerator when he gave his interview to the media, standing in front of the refrigerator, almost in a taunting manner. The next day, the 25th, the slab that Ward Weaver had poured in his backyard for his jacuzzi was broken up, and a large hole was found beneath it, inside of which was a 55-gallon drum. Inside of this drum, they found the remains of Ashley Bond. There was some fallout as a result of this discovery. The governor of Oregon, John Kitzhaber, launched a multi-agency investigation into the handling of Ashley Pond's abuse allegations against Ward Weaver. Although, sadly, I was unable to find the results of that investigation, I suspect that, as happens often, it was just a smokescreen to make it look as though they were doing something, while any laxness on the part of law enforcement was swept over the rug. Ward Weaver, however, stayed in jail on the charges of rape and assault against his son's girlfriend until October 2nd of 2002, when he was formally charged with 6 counts of aggravated murder, 2 counts of abuse of a corpse in the second degree, 1 count of sexual abuse in the first degree, 1 count of attempted rape in the second degree, 1 count of attempted aggravated murder, 1 count of first degree attempted rape, 1 count of sexual abuse in the first degree, 1 count of sexual abuse in the second degree, and 2 counts of sexual abuse in the third degree. This is one of the few cases that when I originally read about it,
really upset me. Normally, when I'm reading about true crime or even watching videos about it, I don't feel one way or the other about the victims. This one, however, struck a chord with me for reasons I'm not exactly certain why. And it might be the fact that Weaver committed these atrocities against two young children and was able to avoid getting the death sentence, which I firmly believe he should have gotten, by copping a plea bargain and pleading guilty to two of the crimes while pleading no contest to the rest of them. Weaver ended up getting two life sentences without the possibility of parole, which just means that he's going to sit in prison until the day he dies. And again, as I've already stated, I think this guy should have been executed for these crimes. They had more than enough evidence to convict him, and I don't see why they did a plea bargain. I mean, he's really just an awful animal of a human being who doesn't deserve to live. And I'm not the only one who thinks that, because on March 4th, 2007, a inmate at the Snake River Correctional Institute, who was working in the barber shop, attacked him with a makeshift shank, and he caused neck and shoulder injuries. Unfortunately, Weaver survived the attack, but his level of awfulness doesn't end here. You see, Miranda's younger sister, Miria, began corresponding with Weaver in 2009, and she eventually said that she views him as a father figure, and that she had to know what had happened, at which point Weaver, who, much like a spider, was weaving his web, told her that he had seen Miranda walking to the bus that morning and become concerned that she had witnessed something what he was doing, which, if that were true, I would suspect it had involved something with Ashley Pond's corpse. And he had gone down the hill and informed her that Ashley was inside the house and that she wanted to come home, but she needed to see her friend first, at which point he killed her. He also went on to inform Miranda's sister that had he not been caught by the police, he had been eyeing her up as well, which just goes to show the deceitful, manipulative nature of Ward Weaver. I really believe that the whole reason he agreed to talk with the young woman was in order to inflict further mental anguish on her by telling her that she was going to be one of his victims. Few things have been released in regards to the murders of Ashley and Miranda. One of them being that Ashley had at least 5 shots of whiskey in her stomach at the time of death. And this leads me to suspect that Weaver very possibly sexually assaulted both girls before murdering them, and that he may in fact have held them captive for a few days before he killed them. This is a bit of a shorter episode this week, but there is still one twist left in this story, and it involves Weaver's son, Francis, who also has a long criminal history. In 1999, he shot a rifle into a truckload of teens, injuring one of his friends in Shoshone, Idaho, north of Twin Falls. He was charged with aggravated assault, which is a felony, and served several weeks in a juvenile detention facility. At this point, he was living with his father's half-brother. He eventually moved to Oregon to live with his father and his girlfriend, and in October of 2002, he was accused of threatening over the phone to kill his aunt and 2 cousins. Despite these rather serious brushes with the law, Francis Weaver was unable to stay out of trouble, In 2005, he and a friend were arrested for robbery and burglary in an incident in a southeast Portland house, with the story being that he and two accomplices had come up with the idea of holding people hostage and then robbing them. It is known that a week earlier he had confessed and been found guilty of possessing large quantities of marijuana with intent to distribute, although I could find nothing as to a dispensation on the drug charges. Weaver and his friend were both acquitted by a jury in August of 2005. In November of that year, his brother Alex pled guilty to felony attempted assault after he struck an 18-year-old Milwaukee man in the head with a rubber mallet, for which Alex was sentenced to 2 years in prison, followed by 3 years of supervised release, which brings us to February 2014. Francis Weaver, the same son who turned in his father Ward for the murders of Ashley and Miranda, was arrested in the shooting death of a Grants Pass man in Canby in what was described as a drug deal gone wrong. In March of 2016, Francis was sentenced to life in prison for the death of Edward Spengler. Francis and two other accomplices had planned to rob Spengler, who was a known drug dealer, as well as murder him. And while it's been confirmed that Francis did not himself pull the trigger in the murder, it has also been acknowledged that he's the one who set up the entire deal and knew beforehand that the man was going to be murdered. And this brings up the case of, you know, nature versus nurture, wherein does somebody become a killer because of their nature or because of how they were raised? And I think in Francis's case, it might be a little bit of both, given what his father had done beforehand, and I'm certain that he knew what his grandfather had done. But it is very odd that all three of these men, one after the other, first the grandfather, then the father, then the son, all end up in prison for life. Well, in the case of Francis's grandfather, he's on death row, but they all end up in prison for murder. And it will be just as interesting to see what happens to Francis's brother, who we know went to prison for an assault. It almost seems as though the Weaver family is hardwired to commit acts of violence which ultimately culminate in murder. That is it for this week's Deathcast. Again, I'd like to thank you for joining me and remind you that if you enjoy the show, the best way you can help support it is to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you find your podcasts, and share it with others on social media or someone you know who enjoys true crime. I know this week's episode was a little bit shorter than they have been, but I promise you, the next few weeks I'm going to be having bigger cases, and eventually I'm going to be getting around to a multi-part episode where I cover what is possibly one of the most controversial cases of the latter part of the 20th century, the West Memphis 3. Our book of the week this week is One Horse Open Sleigh by my friend, the fantastic author James Mullaney. It is a comical Christmas whodunit that I think, especially given what's going on in our country today, is really worth the read and will relieve some of the, you know, pent-up stress, frustration, and jagged-edgedness we have on our nerves during this most unusual holiday season. Until next week, stay safe and stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deadcast.